accession number 20496, Reel 2.
Edwin Drew, Reel 2.
We got as far as Spain when the news came of the Illustrious being bombed in the Med, and so from then on it was all haste to get the Formidable up to the Med. By then, at that time, of course, there was no suggestion of us going into the Med. We had to take her round the Cape, round South Africa, and up into the Med via the Red Sea. The simple reason being that she hadn't worked up at all, and she would be a sitting duck if she'd gone in at this end of the Med at that time. At least that's what we assumed. So we carried on down to South Africa, and as soon as we got to Simonstown, the Rear Admiral Wake Walker, who was flying his flag in Formidable, decided that he would transfer his flag from Formidable to Norfolk, and Norfolk would then return back to Scapa, and the Formidable would then carry on round to the Med. Because I was a supernumerary officer aboard Norfolk, I was transferred in order to make adequate accommodation available for the Admiral's staff. I was transferred to the Cornwall, which was in Simonstown under refit.
Had Norfolk been a happy ship for you?
Well, for the short time that I'd been in her, I'd only been in her some 3 months at all, but she was a happy ship, yes. The county class cruisers were, compared to other cruisers of their time at that time, were very comfortable ships. They were built specially for work in the tropics and China Station. They had extra height from deck to the deckhead. They had some 20-foot freeboard from the water to the upper deck. And their living conditions were very good for the time that we're talking about. And they were built in, Cornwall was built in 1926, I think it was. She was commissioned first in 26. And whereas many of the cruisers around at that time were pre-First World War cruisers, and the conditions aboard them were absolutely atrocious. But so life was good. Yes, life was good, apart from the war conditions and so forth. Scapa was a difficult place. It was, weather-wise, was very difficult, especially because you were at anchor all the time, and with high winds, it needed care that you were always ready to use engine power in order to overcome any dragging of the cable. So that meant that the engine room department were always having to partially raise steam in order to reduce the availability of power to 1 hour, 1 hour's notice, whereas normally a ship, when she's at anchor, would be at 4 hours' notice. So that meant there's more work for the engine room department. But apart from that, no, there was sports accommodation of a nature ashore at Scapa. There was plenty of food ashore. You could buy as many eggs as you wanted, which were rationed in the UK. So it wasn't too bad. But the trouble was that if you were at Scapa, then you knew you were going to be on northern duties, either in the Atlantic or on ultimately Russian convoys after in due time.
And what was your own job aboard Cornwall?
A big pardon?
What was your own job aboard Cornwall?
Well, we're now talking about conditions in Norfolk. And so in Simonstown, in January 1941, I transferred to Cornwall. I still had not got an engine room watchkeeping certificate. I was still under training. But I was very quickly able to get that watchkeeping certificate once we, Cornwall, had left Simonstown. I couldn't get a watchkeeping ticket when we were tied up alongside the jetty. So as soon as we'd completed the refit, and I was then given the duties of double bottom. And for those of you who don't know what double bottoms are, they're the tanks that carry fuel oil, water, etc. The ship's hull, in other words, below water level. And all means of transferring oil and so forth around the ships to get the oil to the place where it was needed in the two boiler rooms.
What do you remember happening next?
Well, can I that was I was responsible for that, but of course I was a watchkeeping officer, and therefore I would be on watch either one watch in three or one watch in four, depending on the number of watchkeeping officers we had aboard. So once you were at sea, you had watchkeeping duties. You also, as every time you came to dawn at sea, you were called to action stations, because the Cornwall had no radar, and the risk of coming from darkness to light and suddenly finding yourself near to an enemy ship was real, because you had no means of telling whether a ship was there. We had no radar, as I was explaining. So every morning, at about 5 o'clock, 5:30, the ship would be called to action stations, and then if you were on watch in the engine room, you stayed on watch in the engine room, or you'd be relieved by an officer whose job it was to be in the engine room at action stations, and you'd take up a damage control, which was to control damage in the part of the ship in which you and the crew were stationed, below upper deck level, of course. So that your time during a day, you'd be on watch, for instance, from midnight till 4 a.m. You'd be called to action stations at 5 or 5:30, and you'd be there for 3/4 of an hour. You'd then go and have a shower and breakfast, and you'd be on watch again at midday till 4, and that was the way that life continued at sea. Rather complicated, I'm afraid, trying to describe it, but it was a very tedious, strenuous and stressful activity. That's all I can say.
Were you happy or unhappy with it?
Oh, very happy. It was, as I explained in Norfolk, the conditions were good, apart from the fact that there was no air conditioning or anything, and so when you were operating in the tropics, that it was difficult, especially in the engine rooms. But and I should explain as well that duties, although watchkeeping, you were responsible for both engine rooms, you were also responsible for both boiler rooms and all the other auxiliary mechanical machinery around the ship. So, as engineer officer of the watch. So you weren't just sort of fixed in one engine room. You had responsibilities throughout the ship. You were responsible to the commandery, and who was responsible to the skipper.
Were there many problems from your point of view in Cornwall?
Well, the big problem in Cornwall was that she had, in 1938, gone out to the China station. And when war was declared, she remained out in the Indian Ocean. She took a convoy back to England from South Africa, before I joined her, this was. And they docked in Liverpool. Everybody was expecting some leave. And they had been in Liverpool some 12 hours when there was a raider, German raider, reported off Iceland. Cornwall was immediately sent off to try and intercept this raider. And she was unsuccessful. She didn't find her. But they came back to Liverpool. And again, the crew were expecting leave. But within 24 hours, they were sent off again with a convoy for South Africa. So when you say, were conditions aboard good, by the time I joined Cornwall, the lads had forgotten that. But I understand at the time that it was a very uncomfortable ship to be in, as one can imagine.
What was Simonstown like to be based in?
Oh, Simonstown was a great place. It was some half an hour by electric train into Cape Town. And when we arrived, when Norfolk arrived off Cape Town, it was a sight for sore eyes because the whole of Cape Town going was illuminated, and we had come from England where blackout was in existence, and there was this fairy city with lights everywhere. And the situation ashore when war broke out was difficult for the South Africans because there was a doubt as to whether South Africa would declare war. And it was through the efforts of Smuts that eventually they did declare war. Well, before that decision was made, the women of Cape Town and presumably the other coastal cities of South Africa decided that whatever happened, that they were going to support the troop ships, which they knew would be coming into Cape Town. even if South Africa will remain neutral. This really, the women of Cape Town really took charge of the unofficial welcoming parties for troop ships and naval ships. And there was a provision was made for everyone to be taken into charge by, or not taken into charge, but taken into care by a family in Cape Town. And so it really was, for coming from wartime Britain to arrive in Cape Town with all the shops open, no shortage of materials in material goods in the shops, people prepared to take you out in their cars and give you a welcome, was absolutely the very thing that our chaps needed. We needed that in order to boost our ego. It was something that you'd never forget. We, after we left Simonstown and Cape Town, we went, perhaps before I leave Simonstown, I should refer to a dog. A dog called Nuisance. A mongrel Great Dane, if you can imagine such a thing. Attached himself in the dockyard to any ship which was in there for a refit. He would come and sit aboard the ship, or lie on the board of the ship at the top of the gangplank. He was known as Nuisance. In fact, he was subsequently given a rating of able seaman Nuisance, and he would accompany the lads into town and come back again. And anybody who went into Simonstown at that time knew Nuisance. And eventually he died, so I understand, and his grave is in Simonstown. And with a headstone and everything, able seaman Nuisance.
Did you have any contact with this sailor-loving dog?
Well, only insofar as that he attached himself to Cornwall. And I mean, there he was every day, lying on the deck. The lads used to feed him, of course. He was fed very well. He was a huge dog. I mean, a Great Dane. He was no tiny little terrier. He took up quite a big room, bit of room.
What was his attitude towards sailors?
Oh, he loved them. He loved them. There is actually a book being written, which I have a copy of in my memoirs, about him.
You were just about to sail from Simonstown.
Yes, we left Simonstown and went round to Durban, which became virtually our home port for the rest of the commission until we were sunk in 12 months, virtually just over 12 months after we went round to Durban. Durban is a very English port, and I think that's a wrong word, saying English port. It was a port of very full of patriotic or expatriates. And the welcome that we got there was very good. No different, in fact, as good as, if not better, than Cape Town. Um, There's a narrow entrance into Durban docks. The actual area of the docks is very large. In a way, it's very similar to Portsmouth, with a narrow inlet and then a large area of water inside. The narrow inlet has got jetties both sides. And when a ship came in there, especially the troop ships, there was a lady who was known as the Lady in White, who would sing as she walked along the jetty as the ships came in, all the popular tunes. And as in HM ships, of cruisers and above, had a Royal Marine Band and a Royal Marine Detachment aboard, when you came into port, the Royal Marine Band would play. And of course, they would pick up the tunes that she would sing. And the Lady in White became quite a well-known person. And again, there is now a sculpture of her in, on the jetty at Durban. There's a lot been written about her too. The purpose of going to Durban, being stationed at Durban, or for the short times we were in dock or in harbour in Durban, was to accompany three large liners, the Mauritania, the Île-de-France and the New Amsterdam, which were running from Durban up to the Middle East, up into the Red Sea, to take South African troops up to the desert. And so from the time we arrived in Durban until virtually the time we were sunk, we spent our time taking these three ships from Durban up the east coast to and into the Red Sea. And then once we'd done that, we would fuel at Aden and then return to Durban via a large ocean sweep in the Indian Ocean, looking for German merchant raiders. On one occasion, we were successful. We sank a German raider called the Penguin.
What are your memories of that?
The memories of that are, we had two Walrus aircraft aboard Cornwall, and who duty was to fly off from the ship and do sweeps on either side, 100 miles radius, something like that, from the ship. And on one of these patrols, they reported a ship, and which had given her name, a particular name. When the Walrus returned to the ship and gave this information, this particular named ship was checked out and found not to be in that part of the world at all. So by that time, it was the next morning, the Walrus was sent off to find her, and they couldn't find her. She'd changed course, and ultimately she was found, and we came up within a mile of her, I suppose, and she was challenged, and she immediately opened fire on us. We opened fire on her, and in the interval between the start of the shelling and the end, the sinking of the Penguin, she'd hit us with one shell just above the waterline. As far as we were concerned, the damage was done to the main cable, which was attached to the ship side, ran the ship. And as the result of that being cut by this shell, the engine room fans supplying the engine room failed. And the engine rooms had to be evacuated. But unfortunately, by that time, the officer of the watch in the engine room had been overcome by the heat, and he was lost. Lieutenant E. Winslade, Royal Navy. And that was our loss. As far as the Penguin was concerned, she blew up very quickly after we opened fire. And we picked up some 50 or 60 German seamen, naval seamen, who came aboard, who were brought aboard, and as they came on aboard, they just spat on the deck. And anyway, we took them and put them ashore on the Seychelles Isles.
Did they get any retaliation for spitting on the deck?
I mean, we just... There could have been a lot of difficulties, but the lads took it very well.
You mean they ignored it?
They ignored it virtually, yes. So that was the Penguin. It's quite interesting to know that you've already interviewed Mr. Fuller, John Fuller. And he has a regular reunion with those seamen of the Penguin who are still alive.
How much of all this business with the Penguin were you conscious of yourself, personally?
Well, only insofar as that we had this problem. The ship was virtually out of action because the engine rooms couldn't be inhabited. There were no fans. We had to get power to the fans. So until that was done, I mean, there was panic because the ship was motionless. She couldn't move. And one... just didn't know what might happen. I can't remember the actual date of when the Penguin was sunk at this moment, but for instance, if it was after the declaration of war on December the 7th, 41, by the Japs, if it was after that date, well, then of course, Japanese submarines were operating in the Indian Ocean, and we'd have been a sitting target if there'd been one of them around. So there was quite a panic to get the power back to the fans of the engine room. This was done, I can't remember how long it took, but it took some best part of an hour to get it back, if I remember rightly. And then we were able to get underway again, and that was it. The next day, Wimpy Winslade was buried at... No, not the next day. He lasted for 2 days, I think it was, once we got him out. he burnt, his lungs were all burnt, badly burnt. So he lasted for 2 days and then died.